We see that certain people have addictions, and after they have the addiction, then they undo it. Okay? And then they say that it's terrible, addiction is terrible. But with all the advertisement, the question is, why did they do it all together? Okay? Why did they do it all together? Right, also, the question is with smoking. I mean, you know, smoking is harmful. Could cause cancer, emphysema, and yet people, with all that knowledge, they still smoke. And then after they start smoking, then they're sorry, and then they give it up. Okay, that is the question that we're trying to answer. Okay, the thing is like this: most people have a certain sense of reality. By sense of reality, I mean that, in other words, I might have a desire to run after a ball into the street, but however, I'll control that desire because I know that I could get killed if I don't stop. I can run into a car. You understand? Everybody has a sense of reality. Most people have a sense of reality, but the thing is that their sense of reality only attaches to their five senses. Like, for instance, if you have a paper to do and you have a month to do it, when do you first start thinking about it? When do you first get worried? Most people, it's the night before. They know they're going to have to stay up all night. You understand? But they will never think of doing it before that because it's not real that they have to bring in that paper. It doesn't become, you know, but it's not real. There are people I know every spring, right? If there's a Sunday where there's a very sunny day, people are going to come in with sunburn. We know we have sunblock and we're aware of the dangers of getting sunburned. But yet, it's not real to us. Because it's just an idea. Yeah, someday in the future I'll have skin cancer. Okay, but you know, you say it, but the thing is, it's not real. You know, but it's not real. That's why it says in Pirkei Avos, "Ezil Chacham Haroes Hanolad." Who is wise? He who sees the future. That statement is wrong. A navi sees the future. A wise person does not see the future. Why does it say see the future? Because we say when there is a consequence in my action that I'm going to do now, there's a consequence that I don't want, it should be so real to you, equal to as if it's happening with your five senses. In other words, as soon as the teacher gives you the assignment, you should say, look, I know this assignment is going to take around 4 to 6 hours, and I know that either I could stay up all night and have a terrible time the next day, you know, for the last, or I could divide it and do an hour a night and do it over 6-7 days and take my time and not be under pressure. You understand? So the thing is, I could do it in one of two ways, but most people, it is not real until it becomes close to the physical. That it's equal to the physical. But 2 weeks before is not close enough. It's just not real to you. You could know something, but it is not real. What I mean not real is you'll act against that idea. You understand? So now let's go back to our problem. Where the person has to make a decision not to smoke, it's just not real. The consequences is not real to them. You see? So therefore, they smoke. So he doesn't smoke. Then when he starts smoking and he gets addicted to it, he starts coughing or some other physical symptom. So then when it becomes real to him, then he decides to give it up. Okay? Now sometimes you'll find two people that are addicted, one gives it up and one can't give it up. What's the difference between the two people? Why one person, when it becomes really, can, and when one person, it becomes real, but he can't. even though he tries, okay? The answer is that there's the sense of reality versus the addiction. In other words, sometimes in certain situations, my sense of reality is strong enough to overcome the power of the addiction. And I can just, by sheer force, because of the reality that I realize that it's really dangerous, at that point I can give it up. But for some people, the addiction is so strong, or the sense of reality is not strong enough, so then even though they try to give it up, they really can't give it up. Okay? So therefore, you have to understand that there are a few steps here. The first step is that the reason why a person smokes is because he's not a chacham. A chacham, according to King Solomon, is a person that has his sense of reality is now attached to the world of ideas. Okay? Right. Now, so therefore, when the person when he decides to smoke, so it's not real to him all the consequences. But then when he smokes and he senses the consequences, so then he decides to give it up. Then it's dependent on how strong his sense of reality is versus his addiction. Okay? Now, I just want to take one more step before you ask the question. And that is that if you have an addiction, and it's really that harmful, the next step is to investigate the emotions that are part of the addiction. In other words, if your sense of reality is not strong enough to break the addiction, you see, then you must investigate the unconscious causes that keep you attached to this area. You understand what I mean? In other words, like this. When you have an addiction, there are unconscious things that keep you attached to this area. In other words, I'll give you an example. There are people that eat, they're not addicted to eating. Other people are addicted to eating. Why is one person addicted to eating, another person not? In other words, in the unconscious of the addicted person, food has a certain fantasy that has nothing to do with reality. He's looking at food in a totally different light. Let's say a person has a fear of starvation. Now, in this situation, he's not starving. But for him, it's equal to like starving. You understand? Okay, the question is that there seems to be people that don't smoke, so it seems to be that it's real to them, that they have a sense of reality that they don't smoke because they know that it's wrong to smoke and all the consequences of smoking. Is that correct? Okay? The thing is that it is possible that they have a sense of reality, but it is possible that they don't. I'll tell you what I mean. There are people that won't smoke, but they'll eat cold cuts. Now, cold cuts has in it is a certain ingredient, a certain chemical that they put in cold cuts that could cause cancer. And these people are against smoking, but they eat cancer. They eat cold cuts. Okay? They eat cold cuts, okay? So I'll ask them, why are you against smoking, but simultaneously you'll eat cold cuts? Right? In other words, it has nothing to do with, in other words, there are many people that don't smoke, not because of reality. It's because of the societal thing. My society that I belong to don't smoke cigarettes, but they do eat cold cuts. So I am not living in, slowly. I'm not living in a world of reality. It just so happens my society doesn't smoke. For some reason, whatever the reason is, they don't smoke. But they do eat cold cuts. So therefore, I'm really not living in a world of reality. You understand? If you have a sense of reality that's attached to ideas, you see, then it'll attach to all ideas and you'll guide your life by ideas. You cannot have a sense of reality in one item and not in another item. It's a personality it's a personality development. You have a sense of reality that's attached to your five senses. Okay? Now, through the study of Mishlei, or through these discussions which are based on ideas of Mishlei, we can extend your sense of reality to the world of ideas. Okay? Now, the thing is that it doesn't attach to one and not another. So therefore, if I don't smoke, but I eat cold cuts, and I know cold cuts is harmful to me, so then it's not, the reason why I don't smoke is not because of my sense of reality. Because you see that I don't care about, I don't think cancer is that harmful, or I'm not aware, it's not real to me that I will get cancer by cold cuts. The only question is, so why don't I have the same thing by smoking? It's just because my society doesn't smoke. It can't be because of the sense of reality. So therefore, sometimes when you do the right thing, you have to see if it is because of a sense of reality or it's because of the society. And therefore, I'm doing the right thing, but not because of my sense of reality. In other words, if you know the truth and you have a sense of reality, unless there's a powerful emotion stopping you, it is impossible not to do it. You must do that which the mind sees. If you have a sense of reality and you know that this thing is harmful, then you will not do it. Or if you know that it's beneficial, you will do it, unless you have a powerful emotion. In other words, what I'm saying is you don't have to experience the thing for it to be real, but your mind will tell you this is harmful and therefore you will not do it. But that, it's not a matter of knowing, it's a matter of a sense of reality becomes real to you. You see? It's that, and everybody has a sense of reality that you're born with. But the sense of reality is when you're born with it is attached only to your five senses. But then there's a training, and that's the training of Mishlei, of to extend that sense of reality to the world of ideas, that without experience, if you know it, then you will do it. Okay. The question that's being asked is, if somebody is involved in the physical world, the pleasures of the physical world, can he take that energy and place it into the study of Torah? Is that correct? All right, that's the question. In other words, you are involved in the pleasures of the physical world, okay? And then you sit down to learn Torah, and you would like to put your energy into the world of learning, okay? How would you get to move your psychological energy, not your physical energy? In other words, there's a psychological part that motivates you and drives you, so there's a lot of energy driving you towards the physical pleasure. So when you're totally involved in the physical world, what you want to do is now put your energy into the world of learning. Can you do that? Okay? That is the question. In other words, there's two types of energy. There's physical energy, and then you must have psychological energy. It's called psychic energy, where the emotions are go to a certain area. In other words, like this. When you play basketball, you have a tremendous amount of energy, right? When you come into class, you're suddenly tired. What's the matter? Don't you have the same energy? You go out and play football, all the energy, you go this and that. Your mother asks you to take out the garbage, you don't have the energy. You understand? Now, physically you have the energy, but emotionally, your energy when it comes to responsibility suddenly drops. You don't want responsibility, so therefore your energy level drops. That is not physical. Physically you have the same energy. But psychologically you're not attached to it, so psychological energy doesn't go there. Psychological energy goes to what you enjoy and what you're attached to. Okay? So therefore, the question is, can you take the energy that you have for football and basketball, going to the movies and all your physical pleasures, can you reroute it somehow and get that energy into the world of learning? All right. Let's take, you'll notice a little kid has a toy, okay? His favorite toy. And suddenly that toy breaks. And the kid is very sad. He cries. And he's sad for a day or two. And then suddenly you'll notice that he gets involved with something new. Right? He gets involved with something new. Okay? What happened? Okay? What happened was that he had the energy in this toy. When the toy was broken, so it took him a little while to pull his energy out. The toy is not there. So he pulls his energy out of this toy, and then in a few days he has the energy to put into something else. In other words, that has to be where that thing doesn't exist anymore, so you put it into something else. Same thing with mourning in general, where a person dies. Somebody you love very much dies. So you mourn. What is mourning? Where logically the person is dead, and you know he doesn't exist anymore. But however emotionally, you're still attached to that person, and you're removing your attachment from the person, and so now you can put that energy that you put into that person to something else. Okay? You understand? Let's say, for instance, I have a certain pleasure that, the reason why I go for this pleasure is because all my friends are doing it. Let's say, for instance, I go out and play basketball, but I really don't enjoy it, okay? I really do it only because my friends are doing it, okay? Now, let's say what happens is somebody sits me down and shows me clearly that I really don't enjoy the pleasure. In other words, I wasn't aware of it. I thought I enjoyed the pleasure, and I'm going out, but unconsciously I was doing it because all my friends are doing it. Then let's say I find out, somebody shows me this idea and say, look, you're doing it only because of your friends. You don't really enjoy it. Okay? At that moment, when I see that, I see how stupid this is. Why should I spend hours playing, let's say, basketball, because all my friends are enjoying it? I could do something that I want to enjoy. At that moment, the attachment to basketball dies, because I realize it's a fake. I really never really enjoyed it. You see? So therefore, it doesn't die like in the first case. In the first case, it was like the toy broke or a family member dies. In the second case, in my mind, I see it's of no value. You see? When I see it's of no value, when my mind sees it's of no value, so then it falls by the wayside, and now I have that energy to put into something else. Okay? Is that clear? So the thing is, what I have to do is this. There are two types of pleasures in the physical, that they're in the physical world. One type of pleasure is a fake out. I'll give you an example. Let's say, for instance, ego. I do something because people are going to look at me as great. Okay? Now, that's a fake. In other words, I am doing an act, very possible that I don't even enjoy, but I do it because you're going to clap, because you're going to say, good job. That's all I'm doing it for. All of a sudden I say, that is not a pleasure. I mean, a physical pleasure. On a hot day, I jump into a cold pool. Or on a cold day, I go into a hot tub. You understand? That's a real physical pleasure. Or, for instance, I'm hungry and I eat, so I remove my hunger. That's a physical pleasure. Or taste. I eat something because it tastes. That's physical. But there's certain pleasures that I fake myself out. That's an ego pleasure. Like, for instance, let's say I'm in competition and I beat you. Okay? Question is, I'm doing an act that I might not enjoy, but it just, I create a, if I beat you, then I'm special. I mean, it's not, there's nothing in reality that says I'm better than you if I could run better than you. It's nothing there. It's not a real thing. So the thing is that one type of pleasure I remove and I remove my energy from it by seeing that it's a total fake out, that it's not real. The question is, but the fact is, it still makes me feel good. When I am in competition, I still feel good. So why shouldn't I do it for that good feeling? That's right. So the question is, I still enjoy when I win a competition, I feel good about myself, right? So therefore, the thing is, why shouldn't I continue feeling good about myself? Why shouldn't I continue doing that? Okay? To answer that question, I have to clarify exactly what's wrong with competition. Okay? What is the fantasy of competition? Okay? There are two ways of evaluating yourself. Okay? One way of evaluating myself is relationship to others. Okay? So in other words, like this, when I win a race, so in relationship to him, I'm better than him, so that makes me special, right? Another way of evaluating myself is through reality. I say, like, if I have to make a living, if I'm not making a living, so then there's something wrong, because I can't live without making a living. A person needs a certain amount of money to live on. So that's a practical thing, okay? So I just evaluate what I need practically, okay? When I evaluate myself in relationship to others, that evaluation is a total fake out. And therefore, what's driving me is that I have a bad self-image. The only way I could straighten it out is if I beat the other guy. You understand? If I beat the other guy. Wouldn't it be better if I just got rid of my bad self-image? In other words, what would you rather have? I'll give you an example. What would you rather have? Let's say, for instance, scratching yourself is a certain pleasure. Okay? There's a certain annoyance, and you scratch yourself. So I say, why don't you put itching powder down your back, get a back scratch, and spend your whole day scratching your back, right? See? Like, you feel somehow it's a waste, right? Here I'm saying it's even worse than that. At least there's a real physical pleasure. You understand? But however, over here, there's a choice. I have a bad self-image, and the only way I can get rid of the bad self-image is by beating other people. So I'm constantly driven to beat other people to change my bad self-image. Would you rather spend your life constantly beating other people, or would you rather just undo your bad self-image so you wouldn't have the need to beat other people? Which would be better? There are two types of pleasures. I'm saying some are a fake out. The example of competition is what I just said, and I showed you clearly that if you had a choice, you would definitely undo your bad self-image instead of spending your life through. Even though you get the pleasure, you still wouldn't want it. You understand? I mean, you probably have to do it until you get rid of the bad self-image. That takes time. But still, no, you prefer undoing, getting rid of it. That is where a pleasure is a total fake-out. Okay? So the question is, what is satisfaction? Satisfaction is, let's say, for instance, I want to enjoy, I'm in the mood for something sweet, so I want some ice cream. Okay? So, as long as, let's say, if I overdo the ice cream, that's danger to my health, so I shouldn't do it. So once I figure out that it's not wrong, so then I eat the ice cream, I feel satisfied. There's nothing wrong in that. In other words, I'm talking about, that's what I'm saying, there's two types of pleasures. There's the fantasy pleasure, which I just said. Then there's the physical pleasure, which is a real pleasure. Like I said, jumping in a cold water on a hot day. Eating ice cream, you feel like having some ice cream. So, or if you're hungry, you remove hunger. You understand? That is a real physical pleasure. You see? So, okay, that is undoing that is just something else. We'll come to that in a minute. So all I'm saying is that to put more energy into the world of learning, the first thing is you must undo the fantasy pleasures that fake you out, the ones I just described. The second one is a physical pleasure. That's a real pleasure. That's a real enjoyment. The only thing is, if you evaluate the physical pleasure versus the pleasure of learning, you will find that the pleasure of learning is a greater pleasure than the physical pleasures.
Any physical pleasure in the world.
It's greater than any physical pleasure in the world, and we could prove it. In other words, learning is a pleasure, and physical pleasures are pleasures. But if we can prove that the life of learning is a better, first of all, the life of learning, but learning itself is a pleasure, and we could prove that it's a greater pleasure than the physical, so the physical pleasures we get rid of by saying it's worth the trade-off. In other words, the fantasy pleasures is a fake-out. So there you have to see the fake-out in the fantasy pleasures to get rid of that. So once you get rid of that, you have that energy to place in the world of ideas. If you're ready for the other one, where you enjoy the life of learning so much, to such an extent, so after a while, you'd want to give up the physical pleasures so you can attach it to the life of learning. Okay? The question is that there's a certain enjoyment in learning, but the question is, but it seems to be that the physical pleasures are greater. Okay? It's a good question. The answer is like this. There are certain pleasures that are immediate, that are faster than others. Like, for instance, eating a piece of cake. That pleasure is very quick. Let's say I want to, while listening to music, I just put on my computer or whatever it is, I listen to music. But let's say I want to learn to play an instrument. To enjoy playing an instrument takes a certain amount of time. There's learning how to play the instrument, and there's learning then to learn the music, and after a while I enjoy the playing. Okay? Well, for instance, swimming. The enjoyment of swimming itself is a certain amount of training. I have to learn how to use my hands correctly and then strengthen my hand muscles. Then I have to learn how to use my feet and strengthen my feet muscles. And then I have to know how to turn my head so I could learn how to breathe in the water. And then I must coordinate all these three things. Now, once I coordinate and I've strengthened all my muscles and I've built up my lungs, the capacity for a longer period, so then I get the pleasure of swimming. So there's certain pleasures that you have to develop before you can have. The life of learning, the enjoyment of the act of learning, there's a certain enjoyment in a discussion where your mind is already thinking. But to really enjoy learning, there's a development where you develop your mind. It takes a certain amount of years until the enjoyment becomes greater and greater. You understand? So therefore, you're right. Right now, if you had a choice between the pleasure of playing basketball and the pleasure of a discussion, there's no contest. You would go out and play basketball. But I'm saying that first we could prove that learning is a greater pleasure, but that doesn't mean, based on the proof, you should give up the physical. But as you enjoy the life of learning, and you actually experience that the experience is a greater pleasure, you really see it, then slowly but surely, after a while, you give up the lower pleasure when learning becomes the greater pleasure. So you give up the lower pleasure for the greater pleasure. You understand? So therefore, so right now, you're right. You would give up learning for basketball in a minute. But the thing is, as the mind develops, and as you acquire a taste for that type of enjoyment, after a while, you'll give up the other enjoyment. Like, for instance, many guys, I'm sure you give up going to eat, and you'd rather go play basketball than eat, right? Some people would. So the thing is, all I'm saying, even though basketball is a certain, you have to acquire a taste for it, you have to train yourself to throw the ball and to build up your running capacity and all these things. But once you do that, then the enjoyment can be greater than a simpler enjoyment. It can be. I'm not saying it has to be. So I'm just saying that the same thing with learning, the certain buildup where that pleasure becomes greater than any other physical pleasure. So therefore I say the way to put your energy into learning is the fantasy the fantasy pleasures, you have to see is really a fantasy. And the physical pleasures, which are real, then you have to see that the life of learning is that learning itself is a greater pleasure than all the physical pleasures, so then the trade-off becomes worth it. In other words, it's just not worth taking a low pleasure when you can have the greater pleasure. Okay? That explains how to go move away from the physical to the world of learning. Feeling pleasure is one thing, but the cause of feeling pleasure is three. There are three things that cause you pleasure. It's the fantasy causes you pleasure, the physical pleasures, and the life of learning. Those things cause you to feel good. It causes you pleasure, right? So the thing is the first one, the fantasy pleasure, you find out is a fake out, so that you give up. The second one is when you reach a level of learning and you recognize that that learning is a greater pleasure than the physical, so then slowly you give up the physical to attach, to put more energy into the pleasure of learning. Right, the question that we're going to deal with today is why is Harry Potter so successful? Okay? Why is it so successful? Okay? Now the thing is, there are two things. In other words, what drives success of a movie, it satisfies something in your unconscious. Okay? And Harry Potter satisfies two components of the unconscious. Okay? One component that it satisfies is that reality is a very scary place. Reality is a very scary place. So to help you, for the way the unconscious helps you overcome the fear of reality, it creates a system that's not based on the laws of reality, but based on powers. I have a special power that's beyond the laws of nature. You see? That's why people believe in different powers that are beyond the laws of nature, or beyond God's system in the Torah. You understand? But they don't want to live by these systems. These systems are not secure, and the life seems unsecure to them, and two, they don't want to be bogged down by these systems controlled. In other words, you have to work out your whole life based on these systems. Better if I have certain powers that are beyond the laws of nature, so it'll protect me. Where I need protection, it will protect me. So that's one fantasy that it satisfies. Also in the unconscious, there's always the battle between good and evil, okay? And so therefore you have the battle here in a lot of times, in a lot of movies, they have the battle between good and evil. But what is good and what is evil, that's not defined, okay? So each person always, whenever they go to war, they always feel that they're right, that they're good. For instance, Hitler held that he was doing the right thing, because the Aryan race had to be pure, and therefore all other races were secondary, and the lowest of all the races was the Jews. Okay? So therefore, he held that he was doing the right thing, because he had to protect the Aryan race. You understand? So each person always thinks that they are right, and they're always battling evil. That's an unconscious part of the human being, the battle between good and evil. What's never defined is what is good and what is evil. It's just based on who you are, what you call good and what you call evil. You understand? And therefore there lies a big confusion in reality. What is right? What is right has to be worked out based on a rational system of understanding of what is right and what is wrong. But however, in the unconscious, there's just a battle of good and evil. So what the movie does is sets up one person or one group of people as good, and then another group of people as evil. You understand? never defining what is good, what is evil, they set up one group as being, quote, nice, they are good, and then there's other people that are not nice, they are bad. And so therefore, you satisfy that battle of good and evil, that good always wins, and a person always feels that they are good and they are right. So therefore, they are the winners, and then plus it has the magic, which is, I'm stronger than the laws of nature, I'm above the laws of nature, I can do whatever I want. This gives me that freedom that I can do whatever I want outside the laws of nature. The question is if this is true what we just said, then the question is, what is the reality, good and evil? Okay, the real good and evil. The approach of Torah, okay, the Torah approach to this problem is whatever God says is right. That is the first step. Okay? That's when I start off. But then I have an obligation and responsibility to prove without a doubt that this is the right, that it is correct. I must prove that it's correct. Okay? Right. The way we prove that something is correct action in two ways. Okay? One is we evaluate the consequences of the action. For instance, let's say a bragger, okay? Somebody that brags, okay? So the thing is that there's a certain good feeling when you brag about yourself. The reason why you do it is you feel good, right? But on the other hand, what happens is you make enemies. And enemies, you never know when they can hurt you, when they can harm you. There's some time in the future when you need something and they're there, and they'll use that as a means to harm you. Okay? Enemies are the worst thing that you could have, because it's like a time bomb that you just don't know when it's going to go off and when they're going to hurt you back. Okay? So therefore, the question is it worth it, that pleasure? You have to evaluate that pleasure versus the consequences of making enemies. Okay? So when you go through the Torah and evaluate all the ideas of Torah, then you will see that you will really see through this evaluation that the Torah is correct. The other thing is, the way you can see that the Torah is correct is through contradictions, where you show, let's say for instance, there's a philosophy of might makes right, okay? What if the person that holds might makes right starts losing, or somebody else is stronger than him? Will he hold, therefore the other guy is right? He's not going to hold the other guy is right, you see? He's only going to hold when he is the stronger, might makes right. When somebody else is stronger, might doesn't make right. So therefore, the guy is caught in a contradiction. So therefore, we would not accept the philosophy of might makes right, besides which we could show that it leads to certain consequences. But those are the two ways how we prove what is the real good and evil in the world. First, we accept the facts of Torah. Then we're obligated to prove and to see how it works. Okay, that it really does work. Another interesting example in justice, okay? Let's say I insult somebody, right? So I have to evaluate my pleasure, enjoyment in putting somebody down versus the hurt that the person has when they're being put down. You understand? That would be justice. That would be evaluated based on justice. It's not fair for me to have a pleasure where their pain is so great way beyond the pleasure that I get out of it. You understand? Or another good example is, many times a car and a person comes to a crossroads, and the car, which one, the question is, which should go first, the car or the person, okay? And many times the car lets the guy go, okay? But the question is, We have to evaluate who has the more pleasure or who has the more pain. Okay? We evaluate it that way. The question is, who would have to wait longer? The person who's crossing the street, when he's crossing the street, does the car have to wait longer than the person that waits for the car to go? Who would wait longer? Definitely the person that's crossing the street, you have to wait longer than the car. So therefore, since there's more pain to the guy in the car because it's longer, takes longer for that he has to wait for you, you see? So therefore, the guy in the car should go. Based on our evaluation, there are times when the guy should go. Maybe there's times when the person should go. Like, for instance, if a person is a pouring rain, then maybe you should let him go. Or if a person is an invalid, so they'll never get across because there's always a car. They go very slow. They're going to have to stop some car. So therefore, based on the idea of evaluation, in usual, in most cases, you should let the car go first because you will have less pain than the car waiting for you walking. Right. The way we're talking about free will, the way free will works is that you start off the life of your emotions. Like our sages say, a chazal say that the yetzirah when you start out in life, you start out with the yetzirah, and then around 13, when your mind is developed, then you get the yetzirah. In other words, when your mind develops, then you can start dealing with the yetzirah. So you cannot take blame for who you are. That was given to you by the way you were raised in the society you were raised. That has to do with that. But you must take responsibility to undo the emotions that cause you to do incorrect things. You understand? In other words, if I had to put it in a way, life stinks. In other words, you're guided by these emotions that could destroy you and harm you. But you have the responsibility to undo it and straighten it out and do the best that you can in such a life. You understand? That's where how free will works. Free will is, okay, that's the way free will works. Now, the question that we're dealing with is when there are two types of catastrophes, one is under the laws of nature and one is caused by God, how could I know when one is caused by God, when one is caused by the laws of nature? Okay, that's the question. Ladies, let's say, for instance, your parents are very nice to you and you love them. But then one day they punish you and you're grounded when all your friends are going to someplace that you really want to go, and they become the worst parents in the world, right? Okay. So the thing is that you notice that your decision whether you love them or hate them is based on your feelings, and it's not based objectively on reality. In other words, reality, you would have to think through what makes a good parent, and then you would analyze your parents whether they have these qualities or not. Let me try another example, okay? You love your boyfriend. He's the most wonderful guy. He has all the greatest qualities in the world, okay? Then suddenly he breaks up with you, and suddenly he's the worst guy in the world. Is that correct? That's only based on your feelings. But objectively, you have to look at his qualities. He has certain good qualities and he has certain bad qualities, and it should not make a difference if you're in love with him or he broke up with you. And objectively, you should be looking at just who he is. But emotionally, you look at life differently. There was a man by the name of Yaakov, okay? He had a son, Yosef, okay? And he made one slight mistake. What was his mistake? He bought him a very fancy coat. Okay? Bought him a fancy coat. And that was wrong because that affected Yosef's ego. Is that correct? Because of that act, Yaakov had to be separated from Yosef. Yosef was separated from him for 22 years. Okay, it seems to be, according to some Chazal, that at the end of the 22 years, he undid that attachment to Yosef. Okay? Now, Chazal say that he was very depressed. In other words, sometimes you can get over things. Child, very hard to get over. Okay? He became very depressed. Okay? Of course, he was depressed. He couldn't have prophecy. You can't have prophecy when you're depressed. Okay? So therefore, he lost out on all the knowledge that he could have had from prophecy. I'm sure he continued learning, but God put him in a situation that was extremely painful, and Yaakov must have known the method of dealing with conflict, and it took him 22 years to undo the conflict. Okay? So because he made one emotional mistake, which had nothing to do with his relationship with God. It was not, let's say, like Cain. Cain didn't bring the best of his produce to God. That had to do directly with God. This had to do a simple mistake, an emotional overattachment to a son, which most people would say is a normal thing in people, right? And he had this overattachment that he made a mistake on that overattachment. Because of that mistake, God said, "You can't. I'm going to separate Yosef. As the purpose was to separate Yosef, but as a result of that, Yaakov lost out on all the knowledge of prophecy that he could have gotten for 22 years. So what do we see from here? That making a decision based on emotions is such a defect in the human, according to Torah." Right, it's such a defect in Torah that God says you have to give up all this knowledge of God until you undo that defect. Right. So what I'm trying to get at with Yaakov is that a mistake, an incorrect decision about even that has nothing to do with God, about the physical world, is a defect. To such an extent that God put him in a situation, Yaakov, 22 years to undo this. He was in pain for 22 years. So first of all, God put him in pain for 22 years. But as a result of that pain, he didn't have prophecy, so he lost out on all the knowledge. So it shows that when you make a mistake because of your emotions, the Torah holds that such a defect that even if you lose out on learning, you should spend time undoing that defect. Okay? Now, when God punishes, okay, it's for the purpose of putting you, as you see from Yaakov, to put you in a situation that directly goes against your emotions, So that when it goes directly against your emotions, so your emotions are awakened, so you have the pain, and the pain forces you to deal with that conflict, because God wants to help you undo the defect of your personality. That's the purpose of God bringing torment on people. What if I'm on such a level that everyday life, I see my defects in everyday life? You understand? So then I don't need God to interfere. I have enough problems in everyday life to make me realize that I have to deal with my emotions. Okay? And if I know how to deal with my emotions, and I know there's a particular emotion that I have, that I make incorrect decisions about it, so then I could work out a situation that I could put myself in, that I will be in pain, so that I could, in other words, just imitating God to the best of my ability, I could put myself in that situation so that I can undo that, and I could keep the pain, so that my emotions are very powerful, so I could see the way my mind relates to these emotions. I could watch my mind, see the way my mind relates to these emotions and try to undo the emotion that caused it. So I could imitate what God did to all the to the different avos, the different forefathers, that and the different prophets, when they had a defect, how God punished them. You could, to a certain extent, do it to yourself. If you have, in other words, the question is that the problems that you have every day, is that God? No, the problems that you have every day is either because you yourself caused it, or somebody else caused the problem, or the laws of nature caused the problem. Let's say you lived in New Orleans during the storm, during the hurricane, and it was totally wiped out. Now, emotionally, you have a certain emotion to that. Now, that's going to show your defects, how you relate in that situation. You make mistakes. What's the difference if the storm was caused by God, or if the storm was caused by the laws of nature? If you relate to the situation incorrectly, and you see that you're relating to the situation incorrectly, then you must cure your defect. You see what I mean? It really, in other words, practically, there is no difference if a catastrophe happened from God or if a catastrophe happened from the laws of nature. There's no difference, practically, insofar as we're concerned here. In other words, practically, what difference does it make if God, insofar as you are concerned, what is the difference between what? If a catastrophe happens by the laws of nature, or if a catastrophe happens from God, I have to look at it. It doesn't make a difference. I have to look at it. I don't know if Yaakov knew that this happened from God. I don't know if Yaakov knew about it. It doesn't say that Yaakov knew about it. We know about it because we read the Torah. It's possible he didn't know. But all he knows is that he has a defect in his personality. That he does know. He knows this idea. Because he sees all the suffering he has. If he didn't have a defect, he wouldn't fail the conflict. If somebody close to you gets sick, again, the question is if somebody close to you gets sick. If somebody close to you gets sick, there are practical things that you have to do. What if you absolutely go nuts or you become paralyzed? So that situation shows you that you have a defect in relating to reality in that situation. Let's say I get cancer and I give up hope. I say, okay, that's it, it's all over, it's not worth it. That's an incorrect way of dealing with life. So then I have to deal with that problem that I have an incorrect way of dealing with life. What's the difference if God gave me the cancer? It happened by the laws of nature. It happened because I smoked. The fact is that this situation is showing me a defect in my personality that God says is wrong, that I must undo. That's all I see. In other words, when the person on the level of development, that he recognizes that making incorrect decisions in the physical world is a defect in his whole being, okay? So then any catastrophe should be a situation where he evaluates himself for his defect, and therefore it's a situation where he can cure himself. I don't say practically you have to do something, then of course practically you should do it. But if something stops you from doing it, then later on after the situation, looking back, you're going to say, look, I have a defect. I made a mistake. The emotions made me make a mistake, which means I have a defect in my personality, in my makeup. In other words, insofar as the benefit of catastrophes, why God brings catastrophes upon us, there is no difference between if God causes the catastrophe or if it comes from the laws of nature. insofar as I'm concerned, I have to look at it of how, if I reacted correctly or not. It's an evaluation of myself. Okay? Let's say, for instance, I have nothing wrong. Let's assume such a possibility. I undid all my defects. Okay? And then, according to the laws of nature, something goes there. Okay? Okay? There is a case where this actually happened. Okay? There was a man by the name of Rabbi Akiva, and he was tortured to death, and he had no defects. What was his reaction? His reaction was, I am a happy man. He's being taken to torture. And his students asked him, look, he's so happy. Why are you so happy? He says, I am happy because in this situation, I see that no incorrect emotion showed up, that I accepted God's will. Even though it's under the laws of nature, I accept that this is God's will. You see, that this is God's system. I understand why God does everything, and I accept it. So I am happy that I lived through this situation so that I recognize that there is no defect in my personality. So therefore, I die a happy man. I don't know if Rabbi Akiva knew it was caused by God or if it was caused by the laws of nature. I don't know if he knew that. But from this situation, he gained one piece of knowledge that was very happy, that there was no defect in his personality. If anything would show up a defect, it would be under torture. And that there was no defect. And not only that, the sun was coming up and he was higher than Shema. He couldn't be bothered with the fact that these people are torturing him. He did the correct act. He said Shema. He said Shema. That was his obligation. He cannot be bothered by people torturing him. He made a correct decision. That is what God demands. That there is no defect in my personality. Again, insofar as what God wants of you, in other words, that there should be no defect in your personality, it should make no difference whether it's caused by God or whether it's caused by the laws of nature. Why God, by Rabbi Akiva, why didn't he take away the pain then? Why did he allow it to happen? That's a separate question. When God listens to our prayers, when he doesn't listen to our prayers, when he intervenes, when he doesn't intervene, that's a whole system, that's the whole Torah telling us how God works. That is not our problem today. Our problem today is only the difference of when God intervenes and when it's the laws of nature. All I'm saying, practically, insofar as you're concerned, it doesn't make a difference. Okay? Okay, but now we'll answer the question of how to recognize, of why we must have that God intervenes at certain times, especially by the nation. Okay? By the nation of Israel. Okay? The answer is that since God created us to live in the laws of nature, a lot of people interpret that God doesn't have anything to do with us. The history of the Jewish nation shows that God relates directly through good and evil. In other words, which has nothing to do with the laws of nature. God relates to us through good and evil. It is that knowledge that we get from when we see God's personal supervision, that's Hashgacha Pratis, that when we see that we recognize that God deals with us according to good and evil. In other words, we must be able to see from within the physical world that God deals through good and evil. You just look at the physical world, it's possible to make a mistake and say, well, maybe God doesn't deal with us. From just looking at the physical world. The reason why God relates to Klal Yisrael before our good and evil is to teach the world that he is involved in the physical world. How much he is involved in the physical world, that's the study of Torah. That's the study of Torah. The study of Torah tells us how much he's involved and how much he's not involved. But the purpose of God, it's true, he punishes us when we're evil, and he benefits us when we're good. But the fact is, practically, insofar as I'm concerned, it shouldn't make a difference why, who caused it. But insofar as proving that God relates to us through good and evil, I must see that in the physical world, that God actually does that. And I see that through the history of Klal Yisrael, and my understanding of it, of all that Hashgacha, comes through the study of Torah. Let's put it this way. The theory of history that we have to follow is the blessings that Yitzchak gave to Yaakov and Esau. The blessing was that Yaakov has the physical world. Okay? Then Esau came about, says, don't you have something for me? So then he gave Esau the physical world. How is it possible? He just gave it to Yaakov. The answer is, he gave to Yaakov the physical world as a means to the spiritual. But when Yaakov or Israel doesn't keep the Torah, you see, then it belongs to Esau, then the physical world. Esau wants the physical world as an end in itself. So therefore, when we keep Torah and we use the physical world as a means to perfect ourselves and to relate to God, so then we have the physical world. Then we'll be successful. Our Eretz Yisrael will have the Beis HaMikdash, and God will be close to us. But if on the other hand, we want the physical world as an end in itself, then we lose it all, and it belongs to Esau. That is the theory of history, if you follow the history of the Jewish nation from Har Sinai on. You'll see all the stories. When we kept Torah, we were successful. When we stopped keeping Torah, we failed. That shows directly that our ups and downs and our existence that is totally different from any other nation shows that we are guided by a system of good and evil to prove that God still relates to the physical world through good and evil. Okay. We're talking about repentance, and one of the ways of repenting is to change the emotions that make us do wrong things. Okay? So we're going to give an example of that through anger. Okay? Let's say, for instance, you're angry, and because of that, you violate many laws. You insult people, talk back against your parents, you're violating respect for parents because of your anger, right? So it takes, you have to deal with the anger. So the question is how to undo anger? Okay? Right. Now the question is, what causes a person to get angry? That what causes anger is whenever your ego has been hit. In other words, all the examples that you gave are true. In other words, let's say, for instance, one guy said that your belief system was touched on. Well, who are you to question my belief system? You understand my ego. Okay. So the thing is that whenever you touch onto my value system, so therefore, that I'm very attached to that, so I get upset. In other words, if somebody irritates you, who are you to irritate me? You understand? It hits your ego. Somebody is annoying you. In other words, my ego has been hit. That who are you to annoy me? Who are you to make demands on me? Like parents or teachers make demands on you, you get upset because who are you to make demands? Your ego has been hit. Okay. Now, the way to undo it is, when you're angry, at the moment of anger, there's not much you can do. When the anger takes over, forget it. But later, when your anger goes away and you have a few minutes to think about how you were in this situation, how your ego was affected. You understand? Everybody's ego is affected in a slightly different way. And you have to know precisely how your ego was affected in this situation. Okay? The difficulty with this is, all right, listen carefully. The difficulty that you're going to find is when you're angry, you're looking at his fault. The mind is outward and attacking the person that hit your ego. The difficulty is turning your mind around to think about your own ego, why you were hurt. Forget about whether the other person was doing the right thing or the wrong thing. That's not the problem. The reason why you got angry is because your ego was affected. Okay? So you have to check your ego. In other words, when you're first looking at anger, you're looking at he's wrong, he's bad, he's terrible, all the things that you think of about the person that made you angry. We're telling you to turn it around and look at yourself by looking at your ego, how your ego was affected, and not look at the right or wrong. If you're angry, then your ego was affected. Okay? So don't look at the right or wrong, just look at how your ego was affected. So you have to turn it around from looking at the other person and attacking him, either verbally or in your own mind, all your hatred comes out against him. From turning that around afterwards, not during the time that you're angry. During the time you're angry, you won't be able to do it. But after you finish getting angry, to look back at yourself and look at the ego situation, how your ego was affected in this situation. Somebody told me that it took him 8 years to undo anger. Okay? It's a long, slow process, but if you stick with it, you understand? Most of you, I don't know if all of you, but most of you will be able at a certain point to deal with, as you recognize again and again, you'll lower, even if you don't undo the anger, you'll definitely lower your anger if you constantly do this. The first step in undoing an emotion, okay, the first step in undoing an emotion is to evaluate the reason why you want to give up the emotion. In other words, like this. Let's take anger. Okay? Let's say, for instance, I'm angry and I tell you off. On the one hand, I have an outlet for my emotion. Is that correct? Okay? So that's a good thing. So anger is good that it gives me an outlet for my emotion, and then I feel better because I feel pressure. The anger is a tremendous pressure. And then I get it off by telling you off, right? That's one side. So there's a benefit in anger, okay? Question is, why should I undo it? I understand that the Torah is against it, okay? And therefore, against anger. But the only thing is that the Torah, after I accept Torah, Mishlei teaches us that we should evaluate the reasons why the Torah is a benefit. Okay? So now we're doing the evaluation. Now I'm telling you that the benefit is of anger, there's a benefit in anger, that I feel a pressure building up in me, and when I tell you off, I feel better. So that's a good thing, right? So the question is, why should I undo this good thing? You understand? Why should I undo this anger? The first thing is that anger leads to actions that many times lead to consequences. Okay? So therefore, you have to evaluate the consequences of your anger. In other words, like this. Let's say, for instance, you have a friend. In a moment of anger, you tell him off. So for that one moment of pleasure, it's possible that you could lose your friend. Question is it worth it? In the long run, it's not worth it. Okay? There are some people that feel guilty after they have anger. So that is also a consequence that you might not like, is the guilt. Some people can get angry, it doesn't bother them. Some people get angry and they feel guilty about it, so then the anger causes guilt, so that's also a consequence for those people, that's also a consequence that they would not like. Or for instance, there's certain people you feel guilty when you get angry or raise your voice. There's certain people you don't feel guilty So it's worth it to undo sometimes because of those people to undo the anger. Okay? Also, anger could make you do actions at the very moment that could lead to consequences. Like, for instance, if you're driving, like road rage, okay? So then you get angry and somebody punked you or somebody cut you off, so you have to speed up and cut him off, and he beat you and you have to beat him, and you can get killed that way, you understand? So sometimes there's really catastrophic results of anger, okay, that you could do things. Well, you could punch somebody out in a moment of anger, and then he could take you to court. So the thing is that all these reasons are reasons why you should undo anger. So the first thing you must do is go over these arguments until you see the value of undoing the anger. Okay? Okay. Another idea for repentance is, this I've seen, is a very, very general thing. There are people that hold from certain principles, certain ideas, okay? But however, in the particulars, the way they live their life, they contradict themselves, okay? It's practically everybody. I'll give you an example. There's certain people that hold, for instance, in the Animamans, we hold that God has no parts. Is that correct? Yet certain people hold that in the Shema, the soul, is a part of God. That means God has parts. So in the universal, you hold God doesn't have any parts. But in the particular, you hold God has parts. Or for instance, you hold you should not hurt somebody. You shouldn't go out and hurt people, right? Then you talk Lashon Hara and you hurt them. In the particulars, you see what I mean? Or you might think yourself, a lot of times you think, I'm really a nice guy because I do this and this. And you don't notice that when you tell somebody off, you don't see his pain. You don't notice his pain. So you're really hurting somebody in the particulars. You understand? So many cases you hold from the universals, but when you act out the particulars, you act out contradict the universal. That is a big contradiction in people that people don't notice. And part of tshuva is that you should start at least recognizing it. You can't change these things. It takes years to change. Okay? But you can't stop working on it. So one of the things you have to recognize is to recognize the contradictions in yourself. That you're constantly accepting universals and acting out differently in the particulars. There is a prayer right before Kol Nidre. Okay? And that is, it's called Tfilat Zakai. And it was written by a man by the Chai Adam. And there was another prayer also written by the Ran. The Chai Adam lived probably around 100, 200 years ago. The Ran lived like a little less than 1,000 years ago. The greatest leaders, some of the greatest leaders that we had. Okay? And in this introduction that they write, they basically say that I'm nothing more than a piece of dirt. And with great detail, they make you feel like a piece of dirt, and they're talking about themselves too, okay? But anyway, I was thinking of one question. The people that wrote the prayer, they're writing about themselves, right? These are the two greatest leaders, you understand? Okay? I cannot buy that they're really nothing, you know what I mean? All these terrible things, I mean, they didn't do it. Or if they did, well, let me put it a different way. When you're born, you're born evil. Your free will is to undo it. And I'm sure these two guys did everything in their power to undo any type of bad view. You understand? And I don't think they deserve this type of condemnation. And I don't think they should condemn themselves. You know? In the duties of the heart, the Chovos HaVavos writes about why did God create an infant that he cannot think, he has no mind. And so he says, because in God's infinite wisdom, he created him without thought, because if he had a mind like an adult, then he would see how weak he is and how dirty he is. He does things on himself, he dirties himself.
He can't clean it up. He has to wait for somebody else. He's totally dependent. He says that, I mean, I'm using modern terminology, but basically saying he would destroy his ego. He would never be able to get out of it. He'd never be able to get out of it if he realized what a nothing he is. You see? Okay. But then when you become an adult, that's exactly what we expect you to do. We expect you to say, to realize that you're not much better than that infant. Because the fact is, you have no... How much control do you have? Let's say I decide and make a decision to go to school. Well, my car could break down, somebody could be sick, I could get an emergency telephone call. The bridge broke down once, the bridge could break down. I mean, the bridge, the traffic could jam up. There's a million things that would stop me from carrying it out. There is no guarantee on anything. There's no guarantee. I mean, absolutely nothing. So therefore, this weakness, in other words, tshuva repentance must start in the framework that I am really not in control. And therefore, I must turn to God for control. In that framework, I do tshuva. It's not that I did all the evil things. You understand? It's just that, let's say, for instance, I don't want to talk Lashon Hara. You can't do that overnight. I don't have the free will to stop it. There's certain things you have the free will. Once you decide to do it, you do it. There's certain things you can't. You have to say, I'm going to work on it now. Then I have the free will. Will I be successful? I don't know. I might work on it. I could be using the wrong method. Or I could be using a correct method, but not for me. Maybe there's something in my unconscious that I'm not aware of. So I have to first deal with that unconscious thing before I can work on it. So I don't know. So even when I sin, I need God's help to help me work it out. That everything I do, I need God. And I must see clearly from the physical world that I really don't have really any control. I'm not much better. You see? So therefore, and in that framework I repent. Because I'm turning to God and I recognize that I must have God. I must relate to God. That is the essence of my life, is my relationship to God. You see? But how do I get that relationship? Only when I recognize that I'm not in power. You see what I mean? The question is that maybe God doesn't relate to me. So the question is how do I... maybe God is not relating to me. I'm not on the level that God relates to me. Okay? There are two types of relationships with God. There's one relationship with God where it's dependent on my level. You understand? Like a prophet, God's personal supervision, God's personal relationship. I'd rather say there's three relationships. There's another relationship that I have with him via the nation of Israel. In other words, if he punishes the nation of Israel, I'm part of the nation of Israel, so I'll be punished. Even though I don't deserve it, like Rabbi Akiva. He definitely didn't deserve this, but being part of the nation of Israel, so he gets punished. Okay? As part of the nation. There's a third thing, that God guarantees that tshuva, well, what's the three? What is tshuva, tefillah, and tzedakah, right? Repentance, prayer, and charity will remove any decree that God has decreed upon you. Okay? Now, therefore, God has said that he will listen to you under these circumstances, even if you're not on the level. If I do not accept this, then all the prayers are lying. Because the prayer says, pray to God and God will remove it. You understand? So therefore, there is a special type of supervision, God's personal supervision, God's hashgacha, on every human being that could work based on his prayers, based on his actions, to the best that he can. Okay? I must accept that, okay? Because that's all the prayers, and other prayers are worthless. The prayers say, not only the nation but the individual. God looks at us like they count sheep. They go through a shoot and they count the sheep one at a time. Okay, God counts us one at a time, that means individually. He recognizes, God knows every one of us, what we do and think. Okay? But however, whether he decides to act or let the laws of nature work or to intervene, that's God's decision. But you can change it through these three things. That's what the prayer says. So I must accept that. But then there's another type of relationship that you have based on your level of righteousness, your level of knowledge of Torah, your knowledge of God. That's a separate type of relationship. But each one of us has a relationship to God.